then obviously you begin to think about what is on his mind and what is the origin of the phrase. I believe firmly that President Trump has no idea what the historical origin of the phrase "enemy of the people" is. None. He does not read history books. He does not read books. And he has stated so, by the way. I don't say that pejoratively, but factually. He has stated that he doesn't read books, that every now and then he will read a chapter of a book that is brought to his attention as something you've got to read. I'm not even sure of that. But putting that aside for a sec, he is not a reader. So where did the phrase get into his head and how?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 273. I want to thank you so much for being here. Today we're going to talk a ton about the media. State of the media, the president's relationship with the media, the people's relationship with the media, in an episode that I have decided to title, Human Rights Are Too Expensive. I want to start off today with this exchange between the president and Jim Acosta, because this was the thing that sort of triggered the entirety of today's show for me.
One of the statements that you made in the tail end of the campaign in the midterms. That this caravan was an invasion. As you know,
Mr. President, I consider it to be an invasion.
As you know, Mr. President, the caravan was not an invasion. It's a group of migrants moving up from Central America towards the border with the U.S.
Thank you for telling
and
me that. I appreciate it.
Why did you characterize it as such?
Because I consider it an invasion. You and I have a difference of opinion.
But do you think that you demonized immigrants
not
in this election
I want them to come into the country, but they have to come in legally. You know, they have to come in, Jim, through a process. I want it to be a process. And I want people to come in, and we need the people. You know why we need the people, don't you? Because we have hundreds of companies moving in. We need the people.
Right. But your campaign had an ad showing migrants climbing over walls and
so on.
Well,
that's true.
They
weren't actors.
They're not going to be doing
that.
They
weren't actors. Well, no, it's true. Do you think they were actors? They weren't actors. They didn't come from Hollywood. Right. These were people. This was an actual, you know, it happened a few days ago. And
they're hundreds of miles away, though. They're hundreds and hundreds of miles away. That's not an invasion.
I think you should let me run the country. You run CNN.
All right.
And if you did it well, your ratings would be much better.
If I may ask one other question, are you worried?
That's enough. That's enough.
Mr. President, I was going to ask one of the other folks.
That's
had,
enough.
Pardon me, ma'am.
That's enough.
Mr. President, I had one other question, if I may ask, on the Russia investigation. Are you concerned that you may have
I'm not concerned about anything with the Russian investigation because it's a hoax. That's enough. Put down the mic.
Mr. President, are you worried about indictments coming down in this investigation?
Mr. President.
I'll tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN. Go ahead.
I think that's unfair.
You're a very rude person. The way you treat Sarah Huckabee is horrible. And the way you treat other people are horrible. You shouldn't treat people that way.
All right, let me unpack a few things from that. First of all, the fact that the president went ahead and said right there that he's aware of the fact that these people come in because there is work for them and they will be hired, which does not mean that they are the problem. This is one of the things I pointed out on the show here more than a few times. He admits right there, they come in because there's work for them. He doesn't say it explicitly. There are employers that will hire them even though they are not legal to work in this country, and we need them here. But they have to come in through a legal process. They are coming in through a legal process. Another thing, you are a rude, terrible person. Rude, terrible person. Okay. He's being rude and terrible when he does that. CNN, your ratings would be higher. See, the president didn't answer the question. He just sort of spouts off. And I'm not entirely sure how anybody looks up to this guy. It's kind of like looking up to Kanye. It doesn't really, I suppose in the land of the blind, a man with one eye is the king. But this exchange right here, which didn't Jim Acosta didn't get into fisticuffs. Jim Acosta didn't call names. Jim Acosta didn't throw anything. He asked a question, and he expected that question was going to be answered. And for that, he got thrown the hell out. They took away his press pass, and he had to sue to get it back. The interesting thing about the suit was the fact that Fox joined in on the suit. They too thought that Jim Acosta should get his pass back, not because they think that CNN is a legitimate news organization. I promise you that they do not. But I'm pretty certain the reason that Fox jumped in on that suit was because if this precedent becomes normal, becomes common going forward, they know that they themselves, Fox News, as an illegitimate news organization, news in air quotes, they know that they too could lose their press pass. And people could say, hey, remember when Donald Dum-Dum decided to take it away from CNN or take it away from Jim Acosta, remember? So, of course, they would like to get in front of a Democratic president and accuse him of not being born in this country and not being legitimate. And so they did not want to lose their press pass. There was nothing about this particular clip that was egregious that at all justified taking away Jim Acosta's press credentials or his White House press pass. There is an intern that goes around the crowd with the microphone, and she reached out, and Acosta was lowering his arm as she reached out. InfoWars took this video, sped it up, and made it look like he karate chopped her arm. Worse than that, both the president and Sarah Huckabee Sanders shared the doctored video. Why are they so afraid of the press? And then I love this. So Peter Alexander stands up to ask a question and tries to support Jim Acosta. You want to stand up and ask the question? Fine. Then Peter Alexander begins standing up for Jim Acosta. Now that's where he draws the line.
In Jim's defense, I've traveled with him and watched him. He's a diligent reporter who busts.
Well, I'm not a big fan of yours either. So
I understand.
To be honest,
let me ask you a question, if I can. You repeatedly
you are the best,
Mr. President. You repeatedly over the course.
Okay, just sit down, please. Well, when you report fake news, no. When you report fake news, which CNN does a lot, you are the enemy of the people. Go ahead.
Mr. President, over the course of the last several days of the campaign, sir, at the end of the campaign, you repeatedly said that Americans need to fear Democrats. You said Democrats would unleash a wave of violent crime that endangers families everywhere. Why are you
because
pitting
they're very
Americans,
weak on crime.
Why
Excuse
are you
me.
Pitting Americans Peter. Against one another, sir?
Peter, what are you trying to be him?
No,
Peter,
I'm just asking the question.
Let me just tell you. Very simple, because they're very weak on crime, because they have often suggested members and people within the Democrat Party at a high level have suggested getting rid of ICE, getting rid of law enforcement. That's not going to happen. OK, we want to be strong on the borders. We want to be strong on law enforcement. And I want to cherish ICE because ICE does a fantastic job.
But the question, to be clear, though, the question
is,
why are you...
Sit down,
but the question, but you didn't answer my question. Just very simply, the question is, why are you pitting Americans against one another, sir?
I'm not.
Is that how you view citizens
well,
of
look,
this country?
I'll tell you what. We won a lot of elections last night. We did very well last night.
And but in many ways,
I think it's going to have a very positive impact. I watched NBC this morning. They didn't report it exactly correctly, but that's, you know, very, very, that's the fact with NBC. Nothing I can do about that.
It's really hard to keep up with the lies. I will watch CNN and MSNBC and some of these others sometimes, and they'll come back after hearing him speak for like a minute or two, which just happened, and they'll go, I don't even know where to start, which lie to correct first. So that's what I'm doing right now. First of all, nobody at a high level of the Democratic Party suggested get rid of ICE. Nobody wants to just let the criminal illegals in. Lie, just across the board. The problem for the president isn't that these people are reporting fake news. The problem is that they are reporting things exactly as they are. And they are not on an ass-kissing expedition with the president.
CNN is suing the White House.
CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN.
CNN says the revocation of reporter Jim Acosta's White House press credentials last week violates the constitutional right of freedom of the press. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders says CNN is grandstanding.
So I talk about all of this stuff on the heels of Jamal Khashoggi's death. What happened with Jamal Khashoggi horrifies all of us. And what we've learned about the fact that the Saudis played a role in it and that MBS, the Crown Prince, was the one who ordered the killing. Now, by the way, Saudi Arabia's record on human rights is not awesome, and it never has been. 15 of the 18 hijackers on 9/11 were Saudis. The Saudi government helped fund 9/11. Think about the things that we do in this country when it comes to 9/11. Never forget. For about 5-6 years, you couldn't walk outside your house without being bombarded with flags. They would just ball them up and throw them in your face. It was insane. So I want to get into Khashoggi, and I want to get into what it has to do with them, with the Magnitsky Act. So quoting here from an article over at Al Jazeera, what is the Magnitsky Act? The Magnitsky Accountability Act was signed into law by then-President Barack Obama in December 2012 in response to human rights abuses against Russian lawyer and auditor Sergei Magnitsky. Russian authorities arrested Magnitsky in 2008 after he worked with an investor, a gentleman by the name of William Browder, who had hired him to uncover massive tax fraud totaling $230 million connected to the people at the Kremlin. Magnitsky was beaten in custody and died in 2009, days before he was supposed to be released. At the time of its passage, the Magnitsky Act targeted 18 Russian individuals, barring U.S. entry and U.S. bank dealings. In 2016, it was expanded to give the executive branch power to impose targeted sanctions or visa bans on individuals who have committed human rights violations anywhere in the world. Holding a threat of significant sanctions, the law is also meant to deter human rights violators from partaking in future violations, according to Mai El-Sarani, the legal and judicial director at the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy in Washington. The Global Magnitsky Human Rights Accountability Act is an unprecedented human rights tool. It enables the President of the United States to apply targeted sanctions against individuals involved in human rights violations. How does the Magnitsky Act get triggered? Upon receipt of a letter from a chairman and ranking member of an appropriate House or Senate committee, the President has 120 days to determine if a foreign individual committed a human rights violation. A classified or unclassified report is then submitted to the committee explaining whether or not sanctions will be posed. If so, what sanctions? Violations would include extrajudicial killings, torture, and other gross violations of internationally recognized human rights against individuals who seek to obtain, exercise, defend, or promote human rights and freedoms, including freedom of expression. This according to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. How is it applied in the Khashoggi case? What happens next? So obviously what happened with Khashoggi is a clear human rights violation. He was invited to the Saudi consulate in Turkey. Upon entering, he was locked in a room with about a dozen or so other gentlemen, and I use the term loosely. The first thing they did was stripped him of his clothes. Then they cut his fingers off one by one. After he bled out, they then put on headphones under the direction of the funeral director that was there, and they began chopping up the body. They even brought along a bone saw. So these are the things that we know. And a report just came out that said that the crown prince, the Saudi crown prince, ordered the killing. So what is the response? This morning, and by the way, I'm taping the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. That way, I can just be at Thanksgiving with everybody. The response from Trump is, not only are we not going to do anything, he tweeted this morning thanking the Saudi government for keeping oil prices so low, which, by the way, they have absolutely nothing to do with. So how is this being reported around the world? First, RT America.
No matter how much evidence there is that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia ordered the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, President Trump doesn't seem to be interested. In a truly remarkable interview, Trump said top U.S. officials have heard the recording of the murder, and he just doesn't want to listen.
We have the tape. I don't want to hear the tape. No reason for me to hear the tape.
Why don't you want to hear it, sir?
Because it's a suffering tape. It's a terrible tape. I've been fully briefed on it. There's no reason for me to hear it. In fact, I said to the people, should I? They said, you really shouldn't.
Mohammed bin Salman has maintained that he did not order Khashoggi's killing. By most accounts, the Turks, the CIA, that is a lie. Once again, Trump just doesn't seem to care.
He told me that he had nothing to do with it. He told me that, I would say, maybe five times at different points.
But what if he's lying?
As recently as a few days ago.
Do you just live with it because you need him?
Well, will anybody really know? All right. Will anybody really know?
Trump went on to say the U.S. carried out a punishment, sanctioning 17 Saudi individuals. It just so happens that most of them are the same that Saudi Arabia itself is punishing for the killing. Some might not find that so credible. That includes Kirsten Fontenrose, a White House official who was tasked with Saudi policy until she resigned on Friday. She was reportedly calling for a tougher punishment for Saudi Arabia. Over in Riyadh, King Salman, the crown prince's father, spoke publicly for the first time since Khashoggi was killed. Here's what he had to say. He didn't even mention it. He did say his country would never deviate from implementing God's law and serving justice, then lashed out at Iran. Other countries aren't so keen to let the hook. Germany has halted and even canceled weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. And joint agreements between London and Berlin could even be from selling warplanes to the Saudis.
Do you remember during the 2016 election when Trump said that, yeah, he met with the Russians in Trump Tower, but that was only about adoptions? That was a super strange story. Why the hell are you meeting with the Russians about adoptions? First of all, you're in the middle of a campaign and you're meeting with a foreign power, which you're not supposed to do. It sort of looks like you work for them. And then you're meeting about something that is an issue that nobody really seems to care about. No. We weren't colluding, they said. And by the way, this is clear evidence of collusion. He says, no. We weren't colluding. We were talking about Russian adoptions. And that's kind of the way it went. Russian adoptions. That's what it's about. Russian adoptions. That's interesting. So this article from The Atlantic by Julia Ihoff. Let's get something straight. The Magnitsky Act is not, nor has it ever been about adoptions. Let me explain the adoption part of it. The Magnitsky Act, rather, is about money. It freezes certain Russian officials' access to the stashes that they were keeping in Western banks and real estate and bans their entry to the United States. The reason Russian and now American officials keep talking about adoption in the same breath is because of how the Russian side retaliated to the Magnitsky Act of 2012, namely by banning American adoptions of Russian children. The Russians vowed that they were punishing Americans who violated the human rights of Russians after an adopted Russian toddler died of heat stroke in a Virginia family's car. But the only Americans the bill directly targeted were the ones involved in putting the Magnitsky Act together. If the Kremlin is so angry about the Magnitsky Act, why is it punishing Russians? And the most vulnerable Russians at that. It was such an angry and nonsensical response that it's worth looking at why the Magnitsky Act made Putin and the Russian elite so upset in the first place. So, obviously, Putin's Russia is not a bastion of human rights. And the Magnitsky Act can ban them from getting their money, having access to the real estate. By the way, Putin's government is robbing Russia blind right now. There's never been anybody more corrupt in charge of Russia. And they take that money and they get it offshore. And they come to America and they buy things up. And then, of course, they come here and they meet with Donald Trump because he's clearly got business dealings with them. And the Magnitsky Act says we will strip you of your visas. You will not be able to get your money. You will not be able to get your houses, at least not the ones on the side of America. You will not be able to come here. You will not be able to come and kiss the president on the mouth. And so when they met with Donald Trump in Trump Tower in the summer of 2016, what they were talking with him specifically about was getting rid of the Magnitsky Act. And I feel confident that prior to that day, Donald Trump had never heard of the Magnitsky Act. To be fair, most people had never heard of the Magnitsky Act. But the Magnitsky Act was a response to gross human violations, gross human rights violations around the world. And a lot of those violations tend to happen with people who are whistleblowers. They tend to happen with people who dare speak out against the government, such as journalists. And this is why I wanted to get into journalists today. So when Putin sent his thugs over to meet with Trump, he says, "We will help you become president if you help us get rid of the Magnitsky Act." I don't know what kind of business dealings that the president has with Russia specifically, but they offered him something. Even if the only thing that they offered him is, hey, in the history books, you will be recorded as the president of the United States, whatever it was. And now the president is completely unwilling to criticize them. They have something on him. They have something he wants. He has something they want. Saudi Arabia. And now he's unwilling to criticize Saudi Arabia. This was an American journalist that worked for the Washington Post. And of course, he doesn't like the Washington Post because they report things that are true about him. And now he's unwilling to say anything bad about them. And not only is he willing to say anything bad about them, he's totally willing to heap praise on them for something that they didn't even do.
Your personal interest, your commercial interest.
Well, I have nothing to do with Saudi. Just so you understand, I don't make deals with Saudi Arabia. I don't have money from Saudi Arabia. I have nothing to do with Saudi Arabia. I couldn't care less. And I will tell you, and as most of you know, being president has cost me a fortune, and that's okay with me. I knew that a long time ago. But being president has cost me a fortune, a tremendous fortune like you've never seen before. But someday I'll tell you what that is. But, and I knew that a long time ago, because I don't do deals. I don't do, all I do is focus on this country and making great deals for this country. I don't focus on making great deals for myself because I don't care anymore.
If we've learned anything about this particular president, is that is the only thing that matters to Donald Trump. The only thing that matters to Donald Trump is Donald Trump. He doesn't really think that the State Department isn't doing its job. He doesn't really think that the Justice Department isn't doing its job. He doesn't really think that the FBI isn't doing his job. When he gets mad at his agencies, the agencies that work for him, by the way, they work for us too, but they work under him, a lot under his direction. When he gets mad at them, it's because they're not protecting him. And there's one reporter that says, wait a minute. Okay, hold on. We don't want to lose arms deals. Are you sure you don't have any financial interest in the Saudi government? And by the way, we don't know if he has a financial stake in the Saudi government. We don't know if he has deals with Saudis because we didn't get his tax returns. For the first time since this became a rule, we decided that we were completely okay with getting a complete unknown. And the most dishonest person ever. Well, except for maybe Nixon. So we don't really know if he has deals with the Saudis. Because we don't have his tax returns. We could get his tax returns in January. If the Democrats wanted to, they could demand them. They could vote on them, and they could have them turned over to the American people in January. So whether or not he has deals with the Saudis or the Russians, we could find out in January. I feel like if the Congress demanded those tax returns, that is the very month that he would resign. And he would resign before they got released. I'm no longer president. The Congress doesn't have power over me. Goodbye. But that would be even better. Because right now, Robert Mueller can't indict him while he's president. That we're pretty sure of. I've read hundreds of different opinions on this. And it's unclear whether he can or not. So I'm going to say no. But if he instantly became a private citizen again, then yes, Robert Mueller, could indict him as a private citizen. So one of these reporters asks, I'm sorry, you're afraid of America losing money? Are you telling me that human rights are too expensive?
Because it's America first to me. It's all about America first. We're not going to give up hundreds of billions of dollars in orders and let Russia, China, and everybody else have them. It's all about, for me, very simple. It's America first. Saudi Arabia, if we broke with them, I think your oil prices would go through the roof. I've kept them down. They've helped me keep them down. Right now we have low oil prices, or relatively. I'd like to see it go down even lower, but I think that it's a very simple equation for me. I'm about make America great again, and I'm about America first.
He can't even help himself when it comes to dictators, when it comes to the victims, right? When it comes to the rapist versus the victim, he'll believe the rapist first, right? Believe the misogynist first. When it comes to the murderer and the person that's been murdered, he believes the murderer first. Never sides with the victim, ever. Is this one about money? He's 75. Can't imagine he's got that much longer left on this planet. How much more money do you need in the remaining years you have on this planet? And yet here we are. Money doesn't mean the world to me. Information means the world to me. And we're going to get into the folks that bring us that information next. You can't have a democracy without an informed citizenry. You just can't.
Now, there was a great exchange on fake news CNN. I know, sounds like a contradiction.
So, Sean Hannity, oh my God, I would love to meet Hannity face to face. I mean, just to talk. I'm not a violent person. I don't have a lot of testosterone. I don't get punchy around individuals that I do not like. I've never cared for Sean Hannity. My disdain for Mr. Hannity runs pretty deep. I don't know that there's anybody more dishonest that works for a news organization. Sean Hannity's very popular, though. A lot of people love Sean Hannity. My dad loves Sean Hannity. You know, neo-Nazis love Sean Hannity. I mean, lots of people love Sean Hannity. I do not love Sean Hannity. I do not like him. But I don't know that there's anybody in the world that I would love to interview more, to have a one-on-one conversation with more than Sean Hannity, because his contradictions over the year, they run so deep. And his number one thing on his show is contradictions, is hypocrisy. He talks about it all the time. Yet he contradicts constantly and is a total hypocrite, but won't say it. My father got mad at me a couple years ago because I forgot to call him on Father's Day. I suppose that was my bad. And the charge that he leveled at me, He was drunk. The charge that he leveled at me was, and he wouldn't pick up the phone, he just texted wildly, was that I am a liberal, a hypocrite, and Democrats can burn in hell, and Obama's the worst president. Hold on, I forgot to call you on Father's Day. See, my father has been ruined by conservative media. My father, not unlike the president, really only repeats the things that he hears in the media. And it's not just any media, it's conservative media. Like, that's all that they absorb. The things that Donald Trump says all come from conservative media. He's not thoughtful. He doesn't read. He doesn't talk with anybody who disagrees with him. And that's what these conservative media outlets are set up for, that kind of thing. Eventually, my father was able to sober up, and I was able to, you know, make up and be friends again. But it was super weird because I got this insight into what makes my father tick, what he doesn't like about me. And I asked him about the hypocrisy and all this other stuff, and he just kind of blew it off because he can't defend it. It's not true. It doesn't make a lot of sense. I love my father, as I think most folks do. And I do, despite the fact that I disagree with him about everything politically. It doesn't matter. There are so many other things that we connect on. If I have, you know, someone I disagree with ice cream flavors on or movie types, we're not, it's not that we're not friends anymore. We just don't agree on those things. But politics goes pretty deep. It goes to who we are. And when people disagree with us, we feel like it's an assault on us, and we shouldn't. It's an opinion just like anything else. You know, I think we all want the same thing. You know, we all have the same things that we want. You know, we, you know, feed our family, take care of our kids, be able to afford the rent, so on and so forth. We all want the same things. But how we get there is where we tend to disagree. And the things that divide us the deepest right now is how and where we get our information. I absorb as many sources as humanly possible. There's the old idea, don't think of an elephant. I know of a few progressive talk shows and podcasts where they won't play audio clips of the president at all because it's the old don't think of an elephant thing. You know, if you say don't think of an elephant, what happens? You automatically think of an elephant. And the belief is that by sharing the things that Donald Trump says, you're helping promote the things that Donald Trump wants. But the reason I do it is because I want it to be in his own words. And that's one of the reasons that some of the clips are so damn long. I don't want things to be taken out of context. I don't want to be right because I was able to play gotcha and take the president out of context. But I am not, with all that said, I am not a journalist. I am a commentator. I enjoy assembling these things every week, putting them together, editing them, presenting them to you for your consumption, and hopefully you walk away a more informed citizen. That is now, and that has always been the point of this project for me, going on damn near 6 years now. But I am not a journalist. And the people that do the real work, the work that I consume every day, where I'm able to put all that information into this bite-sized little show, and it really is compared to what they have to do in order to obtain this information, those are the people that I look up to. I'm not looking up to anybody at Fox News, sorry. I don't even know how the hell you people sleep at night. But for the rest of the folks, the real journalists, I'm looking up to each and every one of you because I believe what you do is brilliant. I believe it is absolutely necessary, and I defend these people all day long. Even though I read a lot of news on the internet, I pay for a ton of sources now, and I pay for the sources up to and including the Washington Post because I want them to be able to continue to do what they do because it is so important to me. One of the things that has ramped up in recent years is the murder of journalists, the murder and jailing of journalists. And it's not because they're not reporting things that are true by fake news, as they like to say. And that's another thing that got into Donald Trump's head, because the people that voted for Donald Trump absorb a lot of actual fake news. And he heard that phrase and he goes, oh, anybody that is now critical of Donald Trump, that is now his phrase. That's the phrase that he's going to use against them. There's an article at The Mark that gets updated every number of years, and it's the 10 most deadly countries for journalists. I'm just going to go ahead and list them off. Mali, of course, Russia, because they jail and murder journalists all the time, and it always seems to be with some sort of a Russian-grade poison that nobody... And Russia doesn't just poison people there. They poison people after they've moved out of Russia. You don't mess with Russia. The Philippines, where, of course, they just elected a dictator as president, a guy named Duterte, who refers to himself as the Philippines' Donald Trump. Brazil, India, of course, Somalia. Somalia has always been a dangerous place for journalists. Pakistan, because there's a war going on, clearly. Egypt, political instability and street violence have increased in Egypt since 2013. Iraq, of course, because there's an unending war in Iraq and Syria. Syria, because, of course, that guy is gassing his own people. And then there's this from CGTN America about how things are going down in Mexico.
Being a journalist is a challenging occupation in many parts of the world at the moment, and nowhere is that more true than in Mexico. Since December 2010, at least 11 journalists have been murdered in the state of Veracruz alone. Last month, a reporter covering political corruption for the La Union newspaper was kidnapped and later found dead. A police officer confessed to taking part in the killing and claimed the local mayor ordered his death. Joining us now from Mexico City to discuss this issue is our political analyst, Laura Carlson. Laura, welcome to the show. Now, why are journalists being targeted by narcos in Mexico?
Well, there are a number of reasons. First of all, ironically, the drug cartels are concerned about their public image. They're major employers in many communities, and they actually monitor the press to see what's being said about them. And primarily what they're looking for is to suppress any kind of information that is going to hurt their allies or help their rivals.
Libertarians, I want you to think about this for a minute, because this is their idea. They constantly say, no government, you know, no protections for nothing. Just put everything into private hands and everything will be okay. We don't need a government. Governments are run by people. Corporations are run by people that are unaccountable. And that's the system that libertarians like more. A system of people who are very wealthy and unaccountable. The narcos down in Mexico are very wealthy and also very unaccountable. If you take libertarianism to its logical conclusion, what's happening in Mexico is indeed a libertarian paradise. And people are dragged off and murdered all the time. Journalists are murdered all the time because, see, the narcos, they need, remember what she just said. She said they are the economy down there. They hire people. They need people to trust them. They need people to look upon them favorably. And they can't have journalists reporting who they really are and what they really do. And it matters. The words matter. The police chief can get killed. The president could get killed. Members of Congress could get if they speak out against them. It doesn't seem like a world that really anybody should live in. And when our president decides to take those words, you know, fake news, attacking journalists. They said it for a long time, both here and in other outlets. You're gonna get somebody killed. And what did we have just before this year's election? Somebody sent a bunch of bombs to journalists, to Democratic donors, and then, of course, leaders in the Democratic Party. I'm still stunned that Nancy Pelosi didn't get a bomb with the way the president has yelled from stages about how much he hates her. And this whole anti-media thing, he is still on this on a regular basis.
Fake news. Despite only negative publicity, only negative stories from the fakers back there. And even these people back here, these horrible, horrendous people, even these people back there said, look at it. It looks like the Academy Awards is so many. You ever see this? They can make anything bad because they are the fake, fake, disgusting news.
It's amazing to me that we have a president that speaks like this. And it's even more amazing that we have people that listen to this and they agree with this and they say, yes, this is true. This is the way it is. This is who these people are. The problem is not that they're fake, because they're not. The problem is that what they're reporting is true. I want to introduce you to a gentleman named Marvin Kalb, a senior fellow, a non-resident senior fellow with the Brookings Institute. Quoting here, Marvin Kalb is a non-resident senior fellow with the foreign policy program at Brookings and senior advisor at the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. He focuses on the impact of media on public policy and politics. He's also an expert in national security with a focus on U.S. relations with Russia, Europe, and the Middle East. His new book, Enemy of the People, was published in September 2018. He has a distinguished journalism career that spans more than 30 years and includes award-winning reporting for both CBS and NBC News as chief diplomatic correspondent, Moscow bureau chief, and anchor of NBC's Meet the Press. Cal went on to become the founding director of Harvard University's Jones Shorenstein Center for the Press, Politics, and Public Policy. Kalb is the Murrow Professor Emeritus at Harvard and hosts the Kalb Report on the National Press Club. So why am I introducing you to this gentleman? I caught a video of him this week giving a sober analysis of this phrase, enemy of the people. See, when Donald Trump decided to start saying America first, I go, oh God, that's a white supremacist call, because that's the old Lindbergh thing. And then I heard him saying fake news, and I go, oh God, where the hell is he getting these things from? And he started calling himself a white nationalist. I go, Jesus. Knowing what I know about dictators, about what happens when these folks get in charge, I started going, oh God. And it seems like he sort of knows what he's doing, because he's hitting all the points. He's saying all the things that would suggest that he's a white supremacist dictator. But then I caught Marvin Kalb. I've got a couple of clips on it. I'm just going to give you Kalb's own words, because he puts it together so brilliantly. But what he's specifically going to address here is the phrase enemy of the people.
I got a call from a friend of mine who works at the White House. I have one or two who work at the White House. And what he told me was that you're going to be talking about the press tonight. I said, yes. He said, you better be aware of something that the president is going to be saying. I said, what is that? He said, well, the president is going to call the American press the enemy of the American people. And I laughed, literally, thinking that there goes my friend. He's joking once again. He said, I'm not kidding. That is exactly what he said, and I'll read it to you. And he read this paragraph, including that phrase. And I have to confess to you that I was stunned. I was absolutely stunned. And over the period of the next couple of months, I began to think about why it had that impact on me. And the first thing that came to mind was a story that I covered many, many years before in Moscow in February of 1956. At that time, Nikita Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union, was delivering a very major speech before the 20th Party Congress in Moscow, and that was called the Secret Speech, and in it, he attacked Joseph Stalin. And he attacked Stalin for having fathered a form of communism that Khrushchev, another good communist, found abhorrent. And he gave Khrushchev did a number of illustrations of the way in which Stalin had perverted communism by carrying it way beyond what Marx might have had in mind. One of the things he pointed to was the use of a phrase, enemy of the people. And Khrushchev said that is unacceptable, because you could name any good communist an enemy of the people, and then you would have the theoretical backing to get rid of that enemy. And Khrushchev didn't like it. And I was thinking to myself, here was Khrushchev arguing with another communist about the use of the phrase enemy of the people, and finding that in communist lexicon, that was too much, and you can't go down that path. And here was a president, duly elected in a democracy, using that phrase.
So think about that. And by the way, nobody likes communists. Nobody. It's a terrible idea. There are communists in America, but their numbers are very small, and they're very stupid. Communism does not work except maybe tiny tribal communities. When you've got, 100,000, 200,000, 10 million, 307 million, whatever the population is now, communism doesn't work, right? It's a terrible, terrible idea unless you have a tribe. And so nobody likes it. And here are these two communists talking about large-scale communism. No one likes that. they're likely aware of that, but they're also very aware of the language that they use. And they go, hey, not that communists haven't already done enough unlikable things, but hey, you shouldn't use that word because, man, that's bad. Not even focusing on the fact no one likes your politics. They go, whoa, this word. You can't use that word because, man, that could go any number of different ways. But he's just getting started. He says, so the whole enemy of the people thing, obviously the president isn't aware of history or any of this other stuff. Where the hell did he get that from?
And then obviously you begin to think about what is on his mind. And what is the origin of the phrase? I believe firmly that President Trump has no idea what the historical origin of the phrase enemy of the people is. None. He does not read history books. He does not read books. And he has stated so, by the way. I don't say that pejoratively, but factually. He has stated that he doesn't read books, that every now and then he will read a chapter of a book that is brought to his attention as something you've got to read. I'm not even sure of that. But putting that aside for a sec, he is not a reader. So where did the phrase get into his head and how? And so I did a number of calls here and there, and the most interesting story emerged. Some of you in this room, as I look around, you're old enough to remember Pat Caddell. Pat Caddell was a pollster. Pat worked for Jimmy Carter. And in 1975-6, he was the one, not totally, but significantly responsible for the fact that Jimmy Carter, a virtually unknown governor of Georgia, was going to be the president of the United States. And Pat had a very good feel for the American people, and he translated that feel into phrases that Carter was to use very successfully to advance his case. At that time, Pat Caddell was very much a man of the left. He is now very much a man of the right. And starting at about 2010, he began to do articles. He had his effort to be published in a number of the major American news organizations failed, and he began to look around for other places. And one of the places he found was Breitbart. Breitbart was an alt-right, still is, website which runs articles that perhaps most of you would not choose to read, likewise with me. But nevertheless, I was told that if you want to find out about where Pat is today, you've got to go to Breitbart. So I went to Breitbart, looked up the Pat Caddell contribution, and what was very interesting in this connection of the research for this book was Pat got into his head that the American press corps, there's some truth to this, the American press corps had become so elitist, and the big shots in American journalism had become themselves removed from where the average American citizen was. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, and I don't really believe it. But put that aside, that was very much in Pat's mind. And he is the one who came up with the phrase, enemy of the people, and that the American press, by becoming too elitist, too removed from the average citizen, had become a force that operated counter to the interests of the American people. And therefore, they were the enemies of the American people.
It freaks me out when I hear him say these things because I assume that he himself has some sort of idea of history, some sort of idea where these things come from, and that he's trying to speak to his right-wing white supremacist audience in a certain way that makes them. But once again, this phrase, just like fake news and just like nationalist and all these other dumb things that he says, when he says make America great again, white power slogan, when he says America first, white power slogan, when he says these things, I keep going, oh God, he's just right in front of us, all this white power stuff. But he doesn't think. He doesn't know history. He doesn't read. He doesn't know what he's doing. Someone else put this stuff in his head. And who put this in his head specifically is Pat Caddell, who now works for Breitbart.
Hitler used it broadly. Hitler used it in a way as to encompass just about everybody. Mussolini used it in a rather elitist way. Mussolini used it to go after specifically certain people who had objected to his rise to power. They were the enemies, kill him. Hitler, more broadly, Stalin used it, as I was saying before with Khrushchev, very widely, and according to Khrushchev, wrongly. Mao Zedong used it, but in a communist sense, that the enemy of the people were the landlords. But in every way, it was a phrase where you could designate part of society as being out of line with what it is that you, as the existing authority in society, determined was the right way to do things. Anybody who was a dissident, off to one side and killed. Who are the people, therefore, who by their very nature in the 21st century are the obvious enemies of the people, namely the press? Because we are in the middle of everything. We are the people who are seen. When there is a terrible tragedy in California, it is the press today that is reporting that 11 people were murdered. That's the press's job. But at the same time, it comes through, or it could come through, if you wish it that way, as a negative force. I don't believe any of this is in Trump's mind. He is using the phrase because it just sounds right. When he was reading this on Breitbart and hearing it on the Breitbart radio, and it was pushed to him by the man who then ran Breitbart, namely Steve Bannon, and Bannon loves the phrase, uses it all the time. And he picked that up from Pat. That was then brought into the White House, presented to Trump, loved it immediately.
This is not to minimize the usage of this phrase or suggest that I at all think that it's okay. But I just got to thinking, I was watching the World War II, there's a series now on Netflix called World War II in Color. And there's tons and tons of footage of Hitler, and it's pretty clear that he's the guy in the room that is in charge. And he had this ruthless way of getting things done. And the way he talked to people and the way he moved the crowd and the way he controlled people. And as much as I don't particularly care for any of his ideas, it was pretty clear that Hitler was pretty brilliant. And as a military leader, as the leader of a country, and I just got to thinking, even though our current president is using a lot of his words and trying to implement some of, you know, Hitler's words and Hitler's programs, I said, Trump is not a thoughtful person. He doesn't know what he's doing. He just responds. He just does things. There's no way that Trump has the same objectives as this guy, right? And so I want to put everyone's mind at ease about this stuff. Yeah, we're dealing with somebody awful. Yeah, we're dealing with somebody evil. But we're not dealing with somebody who has a lot of deep-seated convictions. We're dealing with somebody who's not smart, who's not thoughtful, who doesn't read, and who's just regurgitating the things that he hears from the people who have his ear. And yeah, we're going through a dark part of history right now. But just like every other part of history, it's not going to last forever. So by the time you hear this show, Thanksgiving will likely be over, unless it comes out on Thanksgiving Day. It's going to come out afterwards. And so this year, like just like any other year, there was normalcy. We did pardon a turkey.
Today at the White House.
I hereby grant you a full pardon.
Two big turkeys, peas and carrots, won't be on a dinner table on Thanksgiving, thanks to President Trump.
Even though peas and carrots have received a presidential pardon, I have warned them that House Democrats are likely to issue them both subpoenas.
The president also said this is a time for Americans to unite.
That's rich. This is a time for us to unite. And if you've been here for the last 2 years or any part of the show for the last hour, you'll understand that that is not what he really means. And it was nice to hear him for a moment just crack a joke, have fun. Yes, you get a pardon, but you might still get a subpoena from the Democrats. Ha ha ha. We should all come together. Fake news! I hope everybody's Thanksgiving was fabulous. I even got a happy Thanksgiving from Andrea Mitchell this year. No, really, listen.
Ms. Melvin, thank you. Thank you so much. Happy Thanksgiving to the whole Melvin family.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, my friend.
And that is how you play a clip out of context. Obviously, I don't know Andrea Mitchell. Andrea Mitchell's never talked to me. But that's part of having fun with the show is being able to do stuff like that, having fun with media. And that's what it sounds like when you take something out of context. Obviously, she works for NBC News and was talking to Craig Melvin and his mom. But if I want it to be me and my wife, Mrs. Melvin, which, by the way, is what she calls herself, then dagnabbit, that's what it's going to be.
Ms. Melvin, thank you. Thank you so much. Happy Thanksgiving to the whole Melvin family.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, my friend.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. For all the years that you supported us, for all the years that you've listened to us, and for all of you that have become listeners over the years, thank you. I know there's not a gang of you out there, but for those of you that are out there, I really appreciate that you're there. Questions, comments, hate mail, you can send it to us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to inform and entertain and to keep an open dialogue with every one of you out there. So feel free to reach out to us. Thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing. Kevin, happy Thanksgiving to you. And thank you out there for listening. This is Melvin signing off. And now that I've woken you up, good morning.